This Weekend starts right after this.
Now that Human Resources Director Fernando Pino has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, he's completely crushing it. He even has his own hype song.
Supporting our entire workforce, everyone has different hours, skill sets, and pay grades. Motivating and engaging our people every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger. I'm on the top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the top, top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the top.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Breaking bad money habits. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Most of us have made financial decisions that we've regretted. Some may do it consistently. How do we change that costly behavior?
With polls indicating the country is split over Obamacare, what will happen next to the Affordable Care Act?
How to become a better gift giver this holiday season by understanding the art and science behind making people happy.
And LSU may be one of the top teams in college football because of its powerful offense. But new technology in the weight room is helping as well.
This new technology is pretty slick. It's sort of like a video game to a lot of these players. They just go in and punch in their weight and the reps, and they'll do the lift, and the data spits out immediately on an iPad next to them, and the players are looking around, comparing to each other. So it's been a huge morale boost, but it's also just made, you know, the workouts more efficient and better.
Lane Higgins at the Wall Street Journal on LSU winning the weight room arms race. Americans continue to give the Affordable Care Act a split decision, with 50% telling Gallup they approve of the health care law brought about by former President Obama and 48% saying they disapprove. With the country split over Obamacare, how will that impact Republican efforts to overturn it? Let's go in depth now with Seth Denson, healthcare strategist, also co-founder of GDP Advisors, and the author of The Cure, a blueprint for solving America's healthcare crisis. Seth, how do you see this?
Overall, the Affordable Care Act has morphed into, we'll call it, relatively approved by the American public. And that's in large part because there really hasn't been a great alternative proposed by Republicans. And so, you know, in the absence of the unknown, people will gravitate to the known. And by now, people have become familiar with the Affordable Care Act. They like the idea of no pre-existing conditions and guarantee-issued policies. And so those original naysayers, I think, while they're not probably on board saying, I love the Affordable Care Act, they love it more than the unknown.
All right, so if you were in charge of, say, a small task group in Congress that was told to fix health insurance kind of once and for all, at least to reflect today, I mean, what would you say? What are the things that need to happen that, say, people are not talking about?
Yeah, I think the first and foremost is recognizing that health insurance and health insurance reform isn't the solution. Health care reform is. It's the cost of health care. Health insurance, it's just the credit card. It's just the way that we finance the expensive health care system. And in the United States, the biggest driving factor to manage the overall financial cost components to anything in our economic structure is the consumer. And so if you really want to get serious about driving down health care costs, which in turn would drive down health insurance costs, you have to put the consumer in the driver's seat. You have to allow them the information, the transparency of what things cost and when. Health care, we get services done and don't know what we just spent on them until 3 months after the fact. That has to get cleaned up first and foremost.
All right. So this transparency effort that, say, President Trump has been pushing, this is a step in the right direction. It's not enough. Wrong tree? Like, how do you see that?
Yeah, it's definitely a step in the right direction, and no, it's not enough. I mean, let's take the recent proposal that they just put out about hospitals being required to share relative pricing based on the insurance negotiated contracts. Well, while I love that, I am all in favor of that. The challenge is that the proposed rule would say that hospitals that don't comply, they're going to get fined $300 a day. That's pocket dust to these hospital systems. And so the amount of profit they're able to generate by not complying will dwarf the penalty that for complying. So I love what the Trump administration is doing. I think Alex Azar, Secretary of Health and Human Services, gets it. We're moving in the right direction, but we've got to move faster.
What prevents Congress from getting something done? I know it's complicated, but what is it with regards to Congress?
Well, there's a lot of different things, not to mention that the fact that the healthcare industry loves the status quo, and they're the largest single donor to Washington, larger than tobacco, defense, and guns combined. So that's a big part of it. The second part of it is Congress doesn't want to agree on anything, and much less getting something done. I mean, earlier this year, we thought we would get something done around surprise billing, where people could get a bill that they weren't expecting on health care. Surely we can rally around that. But at the end of the day, everybody's got an agenda. And in Congress, they're applying those agendas through earmarks, and they're not getting anything done. And unfortunately, we just need Congress to grow up and be adults and actually come together to do some good for the American people.
We're speaking with Seth Denson, healthcare strategist, also co-founder of GDP Advisors. And he's also author of a book called The Cure, A Blueprint for Solving America's Healthcare Crisis. And we're talking about how shifting feelings on Obamacare are affecting Congress. Is there another country that's comparable to ours that does healthcare correctly that we could steal ideas from?
There is some thoughts around maybe what Germany is doing. Germany has a public option. They have a private option. They found a way to make that manageable where it's somewhat financially solvent. They don't blend the two. So, you know, you either have a private pay system or the public system. And there's some nuances there. I think that they probably, out of all of the various countries, have the better option. But I would tell you, I still wouldn't take that over what we have in the United States. I think the United States is responsible for 70% of the innovation in healthcare that is utilized throughout the world. If we did move into a government-run system, that innovation starts to go away very quickly. And I, for one, want to make sure we're always advancing medicine and finding new treatments and cures for things. But we must make it more affordable. The government can do that by softening some of the regulatory structures around allowing competition from foreign markets. We ought to allow drugs in from other markets. We ought to make it less expensive to develop new drugs and bring them to market and force an opportunity for competition. Those types of things could legitimize our system in a way that is financially solvable. But then we also need other regulations to apply. We need there to be a fair playing field. We need the government, Uncle Sam, to be the referee, so to speak, of how the system operates. Because right now, a seventh of our U.S. economy, the healthcare system, does not operate with a consumer in mind. Mm. It operates with a system in mind.
Isn't that the truth? Thanks, Seth. Seth Denson, healthcare strategist, also author of The Cure, A Blueprint for Solving America's Healthcare Crisis.
Merry Christmas, baby. Should it treat me nice?
We've had thousands of years of practice, but humans still have a lot to learn about the art and science of gift giving, apparently. In fact, we often fail at it, given that $70 billion worth of presents get returned after the holiday season. With that in mind, MarketWatch has a look at gifts that pay off. Here's personal finance reporter Leslie Albrecht. Leslie, help us out.
Gift giving is one of those things that like people practice in cultures across the world, and they've done it for thousands of years, and they're still really not that good at it. And unfortunately, consumers return between one and three gifts every year. About 40% of consumers do that. So we're really, we're not doing it very well.
Wow. All right. So the better way to approach gift giving is what?
One of the big mistakes that people make is they focus way too much on what researchers call the wow factor. Basically, the problem is people worry about how the recipient is going to respond in the moment when they get the gift, and they really want to give them a gift that they're going to open it and they're going to be like, oh, wow, this is so exciting, and do a big smile and give them a hug and all that stuff. But that's usually not the best way to pick out a gift, because it turns out that oftentimes people just want something kind of mundane that's on their list of things that they want instead of like some over-the-top gift.
Wow. All right. So if you've made the effort to ask somebody what they want and they give you a couple of options, don't stray from the list. There's one lesson, I guess.
Yeah. The lessons are pretty basic. It's like, number one, ask people what they want. Number two, get them that. But the thing is, like, we get too, you know, we get overexcited by these like possibilities of giving them something that's going to give like a big reaction. So, yeah, avoid that.
All right. Give us another approach here.
Okay, another interesting thing, and there's been research about this, is that people get worried about giving people sentimental presents because they think that the recipient might like just a sort of more generic gift that they, based on some preference that they have. Like, for example, if you're going to give your brother something and you know he likes Nike, you might just get him some Nike shoes or something like that. But we really should give people more sentimental gifts. They really like it when we go the extra mile and think about some personal shared memory that we have with them. So even if, so if your brother also, like, you know, if you have some snapshot of you guys together on some day where you had a lot of fun, and it's not like that great of a picture, but it helps you remember this time you had together, it's actually a better thing to just go ahead and give him that sentimental snapshot.
Wow. We're speaking with Leslie Albrecht, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. She's written a piece entitled, "Want to Spark Joy with Your Gifts This Holiday Season? Scientists Have a Solution." It's a story about how we often give the wrong gift because so many are returned. There was an interesting point made in your story, too, about we let our own desires guide us when choosing a gift for someone else. How so?
Yeah, this one's kind of funny. So sometimes we intentionally give bad gifts out of self-interest. Because, for example, we don't want to give our sister the brand new iPhone because we only have the iPhone from last year. And if we give our sister the brand new iPhone, we will feel jealous. Jeez. And that will be unpleasant. and so we don't want to do that. Or sometimes we don't want to give gifts that are, we don't want to give gifts that are identical to things that we already own because that will make us feel less unique. So when you're thinking about what you're going to get somebody, look inside yourself and see whether you're really motivated by your own feelings or how the recipient is going to feel.
How about experiences?
There's been research that shows that, you know, experiences tend to make us happier than material goods. And people often operate under this misconception that, like, giving somebody a material possession is better because it will last longer and it will be in their house and they will look at it and think of you. But really, if you want to, like, build good, solid relationships with people, you should give them experiences. Because when you guys go and do something together, you build these, like, happy memories that last much longer than your feelings about a new object in your house.
Yeah. What do you mean, too, by giving the gift of time?
It turns out that if you spend as little as $40 on buying time to get yourself out of a task that you don't want to do, you can make yourself happier. So in some cases, for example, like if you spend $40 to have somebody clean your house or do your laundry for you or mow your lawn, you are happier. And granted, I mean, this is only something that some people can afford to do, but if you can afford it, it's something that really does lead to real happiness.
Thanks, Leslie. Leslie Albrecht, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. There's a path to doing innovation right, which Apple demonstrated with the iPhone. Question is, can Elon Musk execute his idea for a futuristic Tesla truck steeped in IT? We're joined now by Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Rob, take us through this.
As we look at the Tesla truck, there's been a lot of feedback from folks that really don't think it looks all that great, and of course the Twitterverse went a bit crazy with regard to comments about things like if the 80s want their future truck back. On the other hand, on spec, it should outpull or outclimb and probably outcarry any other truck on the market. It is clearly a function over form design. It's built like a tank, even though the hardened glass windows did break under test, which was kind of funny. If you didn't follow that, they threw a big ball bearing at the window. It was supposed to bounce off, and it actually broke the window. Though in post, what they discovered is when they'd hit the doors with the sledgehammer, they'd actually cracked the glass at its base, and what happened is that destroyed the glass's integrity, and then once it was hit by the ball, it caused the glass to break. Hardened glass has some advantages, but once you break the integrity of the glass, it gets pretty fragile. So the sense was that they probably should have tested the glass before they hit the doors with the sledgehammer. But as I say, no other car would have survived either one of those tests. But it just kind of points to the fact that we as a race have a difficult time with difference. I should point out though, right now they've got 250,000 pre-orders for the truck, probably be over 300,000 by the end of this week, and that compares to the Ford Mustang E, which has, I think, 25,000. So they're running at least 10x pre-orders over the Ford. So it does show that there's an interest in the product, likely mostly from the Tesla faithful.
Yeah.
But it also showcases that we just don't like change much. So if somebody decides to step in and redesign something dramatically, we really struggle with that.
So what is the Tesla truck mistake that you refer to?
what Steve Jobs did with the iPhone, and I'm using Apple as an example, is that when the iPhone first came to market, it was a very unsuccessful design. And I say that because the closest thing to it was the LG Prada, which was a design that was worked out between Prada and LG to develop a phone that looked very, very similar to the iPhone. And it didn't do well. But what Jobs did is he showcased the phone's advantages. He focused people on what it could do. And by the time the phone launched, it was much more successful. And, of course, by the third generation, it had pretty much taken over the market, and everybody was copying Apple. The defenders, the folks that owned the market prior to this were Nokia, Palm, and Research in Motion, which was the BlackBerry.
Yeah.
And Apple just rolled right over them. And partially they rolled over them because rather than defending their designs, once Apple started showing the success, they decided to see if they could flip over and copy Apple. And that was just a huge mistake on their part. So there were actually two mistakes in that market. One was when LG didn't really promote the advantages of the design and really get stuff that worked well on the phone. And then number two, in terms of defending their then dominant keyboard-based phones, the dominant folks didn't do it. They just got scared and tried to chase Apple, and of course that worked out very badly. And it points to what could happen to Ford and GM if they don't defend their designs, because Tesla could do to them what Apple did to Research in Motion, Palm, and Nokia.
Hmm. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. He's written a piece in eWeek.com entitled "Tesla's Truck and the Problem with Innovation." Does this pickup truck with 250,000 plus now pre-orders, does it flip the pickup market?
It could. I mean, that number really doesn't flip the market yet, because you need to get into the millions before that can happen. But once again, folks really didn't believe that Apple was going to take over the smartphone market. And while clearly they're losing market share now, they spun the market and they effectively put Palm out of business, who before then had been an up-and-comer with a lot of ex-Apple folks in it, but pre-Jobs Apple folks. So it showcases the potential for the truck. The thing is, though, Tesla, Musk, tends to undermarket. He follows Steve Jobs, a charismatic approach to bringing out products pretty closely, with the one exception: he doesn't really believe in marketing. And you can do a lot with charisma, but you do have to back it up with marketing, because you have to get to a general audience. And Musk, at least to date, hasn't done a lot in that area. And so, you know, taking a successful formula but leaving out a certain one component often doesn't lead to the success that you want.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, the growing metro area that wants year-round school. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
In general, I'm a win-win guy. When I have to spend hours searching for the right part, it's lose-lose. It's time lost for me and lost time for my crew. That's why I order from Grainger. With product experts that have the answers to my toughest questions, an easy-to-use website to help me find the right product quickly, I can rely on Grainger to make getting supplies for my business as simple and seamless as possible. When it comes to getting things done, it's a win-win when Grainger's got your back. Call clickgrainger.com or stop by to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, Breaking Bad Money Habits. Also, LSU football using real-time data in the weight room. And where the school nativity play is getting replaced. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. School systems around the country have been quietly moving away from year-round school calendars after a decades-long experiment. Parents complained about the calendar that lacked summer vacation, and studies found students didn't appear to learn more. However, school officials in the Raleigh, North Carolina area are seeking to assign hundreds of students to a year-round calendar in the Wake County public school system. More from this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
With the population booming, at least one school district in North Carolina wants to keep schools open year-round. Is that feasible? Valerie Borline of the Wall Street Journal joins us now with a story. Valerie, why does the Raleigh area want to do this?
Raleigh is one of the fastest-growing cities in the U.S. There are tons of students moving into the district over the past several years. The Wake County School District, which is one of the largest in North Carolina, has grown by 60% since the year 2000, and they just don't have room for all the students in the booming suburbs. So the hope is by keeping schools open year-round and rotating kids through different times, they'll be able to maximize the efficiency of the school.
Valerie, what does a year look like for the average student?
A year for the average student in the year-round school typically looks like 45 days on, then 15 days off, with a slightly longer break in the summer, generally, but not always the case. So they have, the families who like it say it gives them the chance to have more frequent breaks during the course of the year, to take vacations and off times when places aren't so crowded, and it keeps the kids involved in learning all year round. But it is a big change from the traditional calendar that a lot of parents and kids are used to.
Have schools in other states tried this, and how did it work out?
Yeah, year-round schools were a big trend about 10, 15 years ago. There were two pros. One, you can keep more kids in school. You can get more kids in a particular school. And then two, you keep learning all year round and you avoid what they call the summer slide, the loss of facts and information over the course of a three-month break. But they found two things. One, parents and families were very lukewarm on the year-round calendar, particularly if they had more than one child, maybe on different calendars. And two, the summer slide was not really alleviated by a year-round calendar. The kids did pretty much the same academically as kids in a traditional calendar.
We're speaking with Valerie Borline of the Wall Street Journal about some schools that may stay open year-round, in particular in Raleigh, North Carolina. How does this kind of schedule have an impact on something like a sports schedule? I don't understand how that would work.
The impact on sports is part of the reason that some schools decided to move back to a traditional calendar, because it really does break up the year, and you have students kind of on four different tracks, so one track is always out. So the bottom line being not all the kids on the team will be at the school at the same time. And typically, sports and other activities are part of the reason why year-round schools are not very popular for high schools. They're primarily at the elementary and middle school level.
Is there a situation where a parent can choose to send their child to this schedule, or will it be you have to do it?
It depends. If you live in a really booming area of Wake County, and I should say the suburbs in the western part of Wake near the Research Triangle Park, where there are a lot of technology jobs, are just booming, thousands of people moving there. So if you live in a really crowded part of the county, you won't have much choice, because your choice school may be already full. So you may end up being forced effectively to go to a year-round school, even if it's not your wish.
Valerie, what about money? There certainly must be some pros and some cons to this kind of a schedule.
The pros are you save money by not having to build a new school, ideally. But the con is that it's hard to make the numbers work. You have to keep the school pretty much fully enrolled to get the efficiency out of it.
Wall Street Journal reporter Valerie Borline with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for joining us. We all do things that make us feel good right now, but which aren't so good for us over the long haul. I'm guilty of that at times. Some of this behavior stems from hardwired instincts passed down to us from our hunter-gatherer ancestors, like our tendency to consume whenever we can and to focus too much on today while giving short shrift to tomorrow. Other damaging behavior is the result of habits we've developed, often learned from our parents, that we're now trying to unlearn. So how do we change our habits and keep our worst instincts at bay? Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements has a couple of ideas. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, give us guidance.
Well, often, when we're talking about finance, we're talking more than anything about spending too much and saving too little. And the problem is, very hard to break these habits. We all know we should spend less and save more, but simply knowing that we should be doing this isn't enough. Similarly, you know, we're often told, well, you know, you just need to try harder, but expending willpower in order to change our habits is exhausting. In fact, it can actually backfire. So if education and willpower are not enough to change our habits, the question naturally arises, well, how can we change our habits?
All right, so what about that number you talked about in the story where, wasn't a doctor one time who said something along the lines of 21 days and you can create new habits or make your behavior become a habit?
Yeah, there's this myth out there based on this one doctor's observation that if you simply do something for 21 days, you go to the gym regularly for 21 days, you avoid all alcohol for 21 days, you know, you don't spend discretionary dollars for 21 days, that you will change your habits. Unfortunately, that is not the case. There have been subsequent studies, and they found, looking at habits like these, that changing your habits takes anything from 18 to 254 days. What that means is, if you can keep it up for that length of time, in this case, almost two-thirds of the year, then that new good habit may be set, and it may be okay to sort of, you may find it easy to stick with it thereafter. But the question is, how are you going to get through that period? How are you going to get through as much as two-thirds of a year behaving well? Yeah. And you're not going to get there simply by knowing it's the right thing to do and simply by displaying willpower.
All right, give us some of the basic recommendations then on what we can do.
Well, the first thing you need to do is know yourself. I mean, what is it that causes you to stray from the straight and narrow? For instance, you know, if you tend to spend too much, what triggers you to spend too much? Is it when you're with certain people? Is it a certain time of the day or week? Or is it when you're in a bad mood? I know a lot of people who, if they've had a bad day at the office, they reward themselves by going out and shopping. They shop in order to make themselves feel better in the moment. The problem is they don't feel so good when the credit card bill arrives.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. We're talking about breaking bad financial habits. There was an interesting point you made, too, about things that slow us down can potentially nix bad behavior. Explain that.
So if you know that you tend to do certain things, you tend to overspend, you know, you tend to overeat, you tend to drink too much on certain occasions, what you can do is to try to slow yourself down. And, you know, that might mean, you know, getting all the junk food out of the house, getting the alcohol out of the house, or not having hard liquor in the house. You might, in terms of spending and saving, you might leave the credit cards at home and only carry a debit card or only pay for stuff with cash. You might also make sure that you don't have much money in your checking account to spend by automatically sweeping that money out and putting it in the 401k plan, put it in the IRA, or just putting it in an online savings account that you can't easily access. By making it harder to behave badly, you're more likely to start to develop the good habits that you want to have.
Thanks, Jonathan. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements from HumbleDollar.com. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, how LSU football owns the weight room.
Now that Human Resources VP Ashley Campbell has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, she's managing her workforce like a rock star. She even has her own hype song.
I'm the spark before the fire. I'm the power in the train. I
have a really diverse workforce with different hours, skill sets, and pay grades.
Don't stop, I'm the dream and you should know that.
Now we're motivating and engaging the right people every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
Thanks for being with us. In college football, number 2, Louisiana State has become a powerhouse due in large part to its new-look offense, anchored by quarterback Joe Burrow's devastating efficiency and an unstoppable run game. But sports reporter Lane Higgins at the Wall Street Journal says the Tigers' success may also be partly owed to a technological advance in the weight room arms race that has gripped college football in recent years. Lane, what do they have?
LSU has for a long time been one of the most innovative strength and conditioning programs in the country, largely due to its coach, Tommy Moffitt. And he has said multiple times in the course of me speaking to him and also over the years that he is someone who always is looking for a way to get an edge or try new technology. And they use a lot of different technology, from heart rate monitors to something called force plates that measure how you jump, and other things in their weight room. And they had been using a system that tracked how fast you lift a barbell on various movements like squatting and deadlifting and bench press. And analyzing the speed in addition to the reps and the weight on the bar is a way for coaches to say, like, oh, you know, maybe you're a little broken down and tired this week and we don't want to have you get hurt, so we'll ease up a little bit. Or, you know, oh, you're not lifting enough, we can make you stronger, add weight. So they had a pretty long history of doing innovative things. And in the last offseason, they were approached by a fitness startup called Perch, which is essentially a digitized version of the technology that they had been using to enable this velocity-based training. And it's the old system was very clunky. There was lots of wires involved that fell off. And the consensus was that no one really liked to use it, okay, even though it was a necessary evil, yeah, perhaps. And this new technology is pretty slick. It's sort of like a video game to a lot of these players. They just go in and punch in their weight and the reps, and they'll do the lift, and the data spits out immediately on an iPad next to them, and the players are looking around, comparing to each other. So it's been a huge morale boost, but it's also just made, you know, the workouts more efficient and better. So, as you know, in theory, in football and in any sport, if you are doing better work in strength and conditioning, that's going to show up on the field. And obviously LSU is doing a lot of things right this year. Yeah. They're 12-0. They're headed to the SEC championship game. But one of the things that they've really done right this year is the work in the weight room.
We're speaking with Lane Higgins, sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She's written a piece entitled, LSU is winning the weight room arms race with real-time data. And they've started using this program from a company called Perch. So, not trying to oversimplify this technology, but if it notices that you're quick with a barbell, that means you can necessarily lift more or a heavier weight?
It depends. So the system is a little bit complicated in terms of how the coaches use it. But say we're bench pressing 100 pounds and your coach wants you to do 10 reps. They would, in a traditional setting, that's all they would say. With velocity-based training, they would also say, and we want you to move the bar at 0.86 meters per second. And then you go through your reps and the data would spit out, and the sensors would look and track how fast you're moving it. So if you're moving it at 0.66 meters per second, the coach may say, hey, you know, that's a little bit too heavy. Why don't you take some reps off so that way your form doesn't deteriorate and you're getting better quality movement. Likewise, if you're moving it way faster, then the coach might say, hey, you know, let's challenge you a little bit more. Because previously, there's kind of this element of like machismo that's in a weight room, yeah, where, you know, oh, I got to lift as much as the guy next to me. Like, I want to make sure that I'm better. But that can often lead to injuries and people getting hurt or people slacking off and not really admitting to it. So it just basically means that you can individualize these workouts and tailor it to a player. So say you have a player that, you know, recently broke a collarbone and has a little bit of atrophy in their pectoral muscle when they're bench pressing. Yeah, they should probably go lighter at first, and the coach might not know what to prescribe them, but having the speed data and the velocity data will help them better figure out what the player's baseline should be when they're recovering.
Thanks, Lane. Lane Higgins, sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
Come on, ye faithful, joyful and joyful.
Parents in Britain are facing somewhat of a Christmas crisis this year. There's no room at the school for the nativity play. The reason indirectly is Brexit. A general election is planned for next Thursday to break the deadlock in Parliament over Britain's departure from the EU. As usual, schools are being used as polling venues. Many have to close that day. That means scores of annual nativity plays are being canceled. Parents are up in arms. Britain's education secretary has written to authorities to protest. Schools think other venues should host the voting. But schools are the most popular places. People tend to know where the local school is, and it is often the largest space available in more rural settings. That said, during elections, Britain, by the way, uses a number of spaces for voting, like pubs, hair salons, laundromats, even funeral homes host voting booths. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.